This is Eco Radio KC, a locally produced exploration of positive solutions to the ecological challenges we face as we work to create a healthier future for our community and the planet.
Thank you for tuning in to Eco Radio. On tonight's program, John Fish will join us to speak about recycling do's and don'ts as we approach the holiday season. And then Maurice Person of KC Aquaponics will be joining us for the second half of the show. We'll talk about his business, the garden at East High School, and much more. But first, I'm Natural Lee with your headline news. EcoWatch.com reports the Center for Biological Diversity filed on Thursday a formal notice of intent to sue the Trump administration for allowing oil companies to dump waste from fracking and drilling into the Gulf of Mexico without evaluating the dangers to sea turtles, whales, or other imperiled marine life. In September, the U.S. EPA finalized a Clean Water Act permit for new and existing offshore oil and gas platforms operating in federal waters off the coasts of Texas, Louisiana, and Mississippi. The permit allows oil companies to dump unlimited amounts of waste fluid, including chemicals involved in fracking, into the Gulf of Mexico. Thursday's notice letter highlighted the fact that the agency's approval of the permit without studying risks to imperiled species in the Gulf of Mexico is a violation of the Federal Endangered Species Act. Federal waters off Texas, Louisiana, and Mississippi host the largest concentration of offshore oil and gas drilling activities in the country. Previous records requests revealed that oil companies dumped more than 75 billion gallons of wastewater into these waters in 2014 alone. Records also show that fracking has been on the rise in the Gulf of Mexico, and the EPA has failed to conduct any meaningful review of the environmental impacts of dumping fracking waste into the water. EurekaAlert.org reports, different low-carbon technologies, from wind or solar energy to fossil carbon capture and sequestration, or CCS, differ greatly when it comes to indirect greenhouse gas emissions and their life cycle. This is the result of a comprehensive new study conducted by an international team of scientists that is now published in the journal Nature Energy. Unlike what some critics argue, the researchers not only found that wind and solar energy belong to the more favorable when it comes to life cycle emissions, they also show that a full decarbonization of the global power sector by scaling up these technologies would induce only modest indirect greenhouse gas emissions and hence not impede the transformation towards a climate-friendly power system. Exploring the life cycle emissions of future low-carbon supply systems and the implications for technology choices, they found that fossil power plants equipped with CCS will still account for life cycle emissions of around 100 grams of CO2 equivalents per kilowatts per hour of electricity produced, 10 times more than the around 10 grams of CO2 equivalents for wind and solar power they projected for a 2050 in a climate protection scenario in which power production is almost completely decarbonized. Wind and solar provide a much better greenhouse gas emissions balance than fossil-based technologies. And biologicaldiversity.org again reports, 3 days after President Donald Trump issued a proclamation taking an axe to Bears Ears National Monument in southern Utah, conservation organizations filed a lawsuit attacking the order as an abuse of the president's power. Following in the footsteps of the American Indian tribes who have already sued the president, Earth Justice is representing 9 conservation organizations in a suit charging that the president violated the 1906 Antiquities Act and the U.S. Constitution by eviscerating the monument. The unprecedented action leaves rare archaeological sites and stunning wildlands without protection from looting, prospecting, oil and gas drilling, uranium mining, or off-road vehicle damage. Bears Ears was decimated by more than 1 million acres. That's all I have for the news. I think Mike has a clip for us.
Yeah, that's right. Our local environmental community suffered a setback last week with the passing of Steve Mooring. Steve Mooring's a name that's synonymous with permaculture in our neck of the woods. And so this has been a great loss for us. Steve will be missed, not only for his passion, but his dedication, his brain power, and his willingness to roll up his sleeves. This is, in fact, a big loss. Steve was on Eco Radio KC back in July of 2016, talking about what was then the 7th annual Kansas Permaculture Tour. We've got a little clip so you can hear from Steve Mooring. Okay, Steve, why don't you tell us about the Kansas Permaculture Institute?
Well, it's interesting. Probably it was 2006 and 2007, I became more and more interested in integrating permaculture into my life. And, I was surfing the internet, and I came across a group of people up in Wisconsin that had established a permaculture collaborative. And I thought, that's an interesting concept. And, I'm kind of a one-man band here, it seemed, at the time. And, of course, I ran into other people who were interested in permaculture. And I thought, well, why don't we, work together, form a synergistic effort, and learn from each other? So I, got a few people together. We talked about it, and I established a listserv, and that's a Google group listserv. It's called KPC-DEV. And that's simply as a listserv works. People could, write in, ask questions, interact, share things that they pull off the internet about permaculture or anything sustainable. And then we just started a dialogue. That listserv grew and grew, and now it's up to about 260 members all through the Kansas City and Lawrence and eastern Kansas area. And a few years later, we set up a website called the Kansas Permaculture. The website's kapermaculture.org. It's all one word. And that's kind of a centerpiece for us to also get information out, share information. And then I think it was about 2010 we established the Institute. And the Institute was basically to help support people who went through a permaculture design course so that their certification would be recorded, and that we'd also set up some guidelines for people to teach permaculture. I started teaching permaculture in late 2009. I have a background in natural sciences. I have a master's degree in biochemistry, and I'm also have experience teaching science in the community colleges here in the Kansas City area, Johnson County Community College as well. And I just thought, well, this would be a perfect opportunity to share some of my skills with my community. So this has been going on. We've been teaching the permaculture design course now for about six years now. And I teach it also at KU as a course in the environmental studies program. It's a 6-hour credit course.
And that was Steve Mooring, who passed away last week. And from July 11th of 2016. And that's just an excerpt from the program. You can hear the entire program at kkfi.org, looking up in the podcast under Eco Radio KC. Again, the date was July 11th, 2016. But to make it easier for you, we've also posted it on the Eco Radio KC Facebook page, so it's pretty close to the top of what we've posted there. So again, Steve Mooring, who passed away last week, and it's going to take a bunch of us to step up and fill those shoes. And I'm going to turn it over to Natural E with hopefully some brighter news.
Yes, thank you, Mike. Well, we're going to go ahead and shift gears here, and I have John Fish in studio with me. Good evening, John.
Good evening, Aaron, Mike. In case we're confusing anyone, I should probably say John Fish Kerman. Okay. Fish and Kerman are my two family names. Most people probably know me out there in radio land as Kerman.
Okay. Mm. Oh, yes, this is John Fish Kerman we got. And I'm so glad that you could join us this evening.
Thanks for the invite.
Absolutely. Now, I know you're very active out there in the world. You run the Kansas City chapter for 350, right?
Run might be an exaggeration. I'm one of the leaders in 350 KC.
Of the leaders for 350 KC, which is, tell us about 350.
350 is the International Grassroots Global Climate Justice Movement. Mm-hmm. And so 350 KC is the local group. Okay. That is part of that.
Because that's
around
worldwide.
The world.
Yeah. Yep. That's awesome. And then also the Climate Coalition.
I'm also involved with the KC Climate Coalition, mm-hmm. which is a coalition of different groups here in Kansas City that work on the climate crisis.
Okay. Yeah. But in lieu of all of that, you also have many years of experience in recycling.
I do. Yes, I am currently a recycling center manager for Bridging the Gap here in Kansas City, our homegrown environmental organization, 25 years strong.
All right, look at you. Okay, I'm so glad that you said that because that is true. And we're glad that they run the recycling centers here in town for us. That's free for us.
Yeah, we manage three drop-off recycling centers with funding provided by the City of Kansas City, Missouri, one in the Northland at roughly Highway 169 and Berry Road, one in the East Bottoms on Doremus, a little north of Front Street, and one out south on Redbridge Road and 71, right there at the intersection of Redbridge and 71.
All right, and I think it's always good to touch up on our recycling knowledge because things are always changing, and somehow, you know, sometimes people fall through the cracks with the rules that have always been the same, you know, when it comes.
Right.
So we will go over that. But I also thought it was very important to have a recycling show as we get closer to Christmas time, because there's going to be a lot of packaging and there's going to be a lot of wrapping paper and tissue paper and all these kinds of things, and people with good intentions. So let's make sure that, you know, the paper and the boxes and everything gets to where it needs to go correctly.
You know, the EPA has calculated that the amount of trash that households produce in the United States goes up by 25% between Thanksgiving and New Year's. So all those holiday celebrations and all those presents produce a lot of trash.
Mm-hmm.
And Americans are not exactly short on producing trash the rest of the year. So you add another 25% on top of that, and we have a serious problem. I mean, just go out the first trash day after Christmas if you want to see what a problem it is. And absolutely, recycling as much of that waste that's produced is very important.
Mm-hmm.
Producing less of it in the first place is even more important, of course.
It's reduce,
reuse,
recycle, right. I believe is the
reduce
order.
Reduce is the first and the highest priority.
Okay, so wrapping paper.
Wrapping paper.
Can I recycle that?
Yeah, unfortunately, wrapping paper is a low quality material, so it doesn't have much value to begin with. And then a lot of wrapping paper will have some kind of glitter or foil or other embellishment on it. And the simple fact of the matter is recyclers just really don't want it. And the same goes for tissue paper. That stuff is just low quality material. And it's best just to not put it in at all, simply because it's of such low quality.
Now, what about the bows and the strings?
Yeah, bows and strings are not even made out of paper. They're typically some kind of petroleum product. So they're essentially a plastic, but not a type of plastic that is desirable for recycling. So I'm afraid those are not recyclable either. Now, the good thing about bows is they can typically, I mean, they don't get damaged, usually. So you can reuse them. Even ribbon can often be reused. And reuse is
number two
of the three R's. So
R
is always good. I mean, personally, you know, kids love the tearing open of the wrapping paper, and adults get excited watching their kids. So, you know, wrapping paper for kids, I can understand. But for adults, reusable gift bags, gift boxes, there's no reason that has to have some wrapping that gets torn off and then is of no use anymore.
I was actually at a White Elephant party this past Friday, and two people had wrapped their gifts in a cloth. Like it was like a flowery cloth type. So I was like, oh, okay, I've never seen that, but it makes perfect sense.
Another reuse option, and absolutely.
Then they had reused a string from another present, I'm assuming, and it looked nice, but it also wasn't wasteful.
Absolutely.
So that was cool.
Get creative with it.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I have some information pulled up here about Christmas lights, because, you know, you bring them out of the attic, you want to be festive, you plug it in, and it doesn't work. Now what?
Yeah. So we are able to accept those Christmas lights at the three drop-off recycling centers
that
Bridging the Gap manages. So you can bring those to our recycling centers. Go to bridgingthegap.org. Since you don't have those, maybe we can get that up on the Facebook page after the show so that people will have the direct link to find the information on the recycling centers. Do not put them in your curbside recycling bin, though. Christmas lights are one of the things that are classified as tanglers. And what that means is they are things that get tangled up in the conveyor belts and other machinery that are used at a materials recovery facility to separate all those things. You know, you put your things in your curbside bin, you get all these materials mixed in together. They obviously can't be recycled that way. They got to get separated into different categories at some point. A lot of that's done mechanically. Some of it's done by hand. But things like plastic bags and some people will throw rope in their recycling bins, Christmas lights, power cords. Those are tanglers. So they tangle up the machinery. They can make the machinery stop. Could even cause, you know, burnouts of the motors that run the machines. Do not put anything that's likely to get tangled into your curbside recycling bin.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We won't do that then. But I can bring them to Bridging the Gap. Can you do that year-round, bring the Christmas lights?
Yeah, we'll take them year-round.
Okay. I did not know that, because I know during this season, from about now until into January, there are places around the metro area that open up their
doors. There are typically special places that take those, and they're often like sheltered workshops that give employment to people who are disabled in one way or another.
Yeah, like Southeast Enterprises.
And they only those places only accept in this time of year, because this is when people discover, oh, hey, those lights aren't working anymore. Right. But we take wire of various kinds throughout the year. We take basically four categories of wire, including Christmas lights, which are classified as fine wire, because the wire in there, the copper wire in there, is a very fine grade of wire.
Mm-hmm. Did I miss anything Christmas packaging-wise that you guys can think of that I...
One of my pet peeves a lot of things we get with Christmas packaging is toy boxes that have these plastic windows in them, or plastic handles on the boxes. So the box, the paper material, is recyclable, but the plastic handle needs to come off of there, because it shouldn't be recycled along with the paper. It can't be recycled along with the paper.
So you'll take it off, right?
Well, we'd rather We'd rather the patrons do it. The fact of the matter is, recycling, for it to work, for it to work economically, it has to be a cooperative effort between the residents who want to recycle their stuff, and those of us at the recycling centers who accept it, the drop-off centers, and the companies that it ultimately goes to here in Kansas City, that further process it and then sell that stuff off to the companies that actually make materials. And if we have to do all the work for residents, it will never work, because we don't have recycling is not a big money maker.
Right.
So we can't have huge staff at the recycling centers to do the work for people.
To take the plastic
It's absolutely essential that people look up our guidelines before they come to the recycling centers and follow those guidelines. Only bring us the stuff we accept and bring it in the form we accept. It's really absolutely essential. While we're talking holidays, we should talk about the waste from holiday parties. First of all, back to the first R, reduce. Avoid those disposables at your holiday parties.
Don't
use the paper plates and the plastic cups that are single-use cups and the plastic utensils. It's a holiday party. It should be special. Use the good stuff. Yeah, come on. And the fact of the matter is, if for whatever reason you can't use the good stuff, you're not going to be able to make yourself feel better by recycling it, because all those paper plates and paper cups are landfill. They're trash. They should not go into your recycling. The coatings they put on those so that the food and drink don't leak through them make them not recyclable with other paper products. Plus, they're typically going to have food on them. Are you going to wash your paper plates and cups before you put them in the recycling? Probably not. So those are just going to be trash. Just best thing is to avoid them altogether.
Let me jump in here. First of all, just to follow up the Naturalese question about any other thing about Christmas packaging. So like sometimes you see a like a doll comes in a box with a cellophane window in it.
Right.
So do you have to take that window out?
Those need to come out. Okay. Yeah, absolutely.
What about styrofoam?
Yeah, foam's a big problem. So what a lot of people don't realize, and they get frustrated with this, we took it's actually technically not styrofoam. What most people call styrofoam is actually expanded polystyrene, EPS. It's those white blocks is what we're talking about, or sometimes it's in sheets too. What it is it's number 6 polystyrene plastic, a tiny amount of it expanded with a whole lot of air. On average, styrofoam is about 98% air. That's why it does what it does so well, why it cushions so well, is because it's actually mostly air despite the bulk that it takes up. So the problem with that is it takes up a lot of space for very little actual recyclable material. And on top of that, because the recyclers want to make new white styrofoam, it has to be absolutely clean to recycle. So it's really problematic to recycle. And ultimately, it proved untenable to take it for recycling at the drop-off recycling centers. And it's just, there's a styrofoam manufacturer over in Kansas City, Kansas, that will take styrofoam for recycling as long as it's completely clean. But frankly, if you have to drive it very far because there's so little material there to be recycled, it's not worth burning the gas to drive it from Grandview or whatever over to Kansas City, Kansas to recycle it. You do more harm than good by driving it over there.
Right.
So styrofoam is just a real problem. We need to figure out ways to just avoid it as much as possible.
And I just took a call real quickly, and the caller said to ask about old artificial Christmas trees.
There are some places that do take artificial Christmas trees. We will take those in our scrap metal bins at the recycling centers. So that is an option. And I think there are actually places, I had heard a name on this. There was somebody who was taking them and maybe refurbishing them and giving them out to people who can't afford a tree or something like that. But unfortunately, I cannot remember the name of that right off the top of my head. But someone who's interested in doing that with an old tree you have might just Google recycle.
We might find that at recyclespot.org.
Yeah, it might be right now.
Recyclespot.org is actually an excellent resource. Thanks for bringing that up, because I wanted to make sure we mentioned that tonight. Because it might not be convenient for folks to come to one of Bridging the Gaps recycling centers, but you still want to recycle something. So if you go to recyclespot.org, which is operated by the Mid-America Regional Council, our sort of metropolitan planning agency, you can search by material, whatever you want to recycle, and find the closest place to recycle it, assuming there is some place to recycle whatever it is you have. And they recently did a really cool poster, too, which shows in visual terms what kinds of things can and cannot go in curbside recycling bins throughout the metro area. And you can download that from recyclespot.org, too.
On recyclespot.org, I tried to type in artificial Christmas tree. That didn't have that, but they had artificial flowers. Kind of not. I don't want to give it. Scraps KC takes artificial flowers.
Scraps KC is kind of an interesting place. They take a variety of odd things, but don't just take your odd things over there. Call ahead.
I was like, I shouldn't even say that on
call
the air.
Call ahead.
Yeah, that's like the worst thing in the world.
Because sometimes I had a friend who wanted to dispose of a bunch of kombucha bottles. He's a kombucha aficionado, and I was like, well, they're not really suitable for reuse because the lids won't reseal. You can't buy a lid that's going to seal it for use for food or drink. So I suggested, well, maybe Scraps KC will take some. Well, yeah, hundreds. They took some, but they're not going to take hundreds.
You can just recycle the glass.
You can recycle the glass, but he was hoping to go upstream of that to a reuse option.
Right.
A higher purpose if possible, but it didn't prove to be feasible. Most of it ended up going to our local glass recycler.
Yeah. Well, that's better than nothing.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, I'm glad we covered the lights. And I know there's places that take real Christmas trees. You can find that really easy if you just Google that.
Yeah.
But yeah, recyclespot.org. I love that. I love it. It's great. You type in whatever item you have and then give them a zip code and they'll tell you where to take it, you know. But like John said, there's usually a phone number on there, so call ahead. Or if you're coming to the recycling centers, you can check out their rules. Is that on bridgingthegap.org?
Yes, our list of accepted materials at the drop-off recycling centers is on bridgingthegap.org. And all that's up there. You know, recycling is becoming increasingly challenging. A lot of drop-off centers around the metro area have closed over the last year or two. And it's largely due to the fact that the economics of recycling have become more difficult. China, in particular, which has been a major importer of recyclable materials from the United States, has raised the bar much higher for what they'll accept. Frankly, they got tired of accepting junk from the United States. Stuff was being sent over there with a lot of contamination, which that's the industry term for stuff that gets mixed in that's not supposed to be mixed in, like plastic bags in a bale of paper or food contaminated things. You know, don't rinse your stuff out before you recycle it. Don't send it to the recycling center with a bunch of food all over it, because not only is that not recyclable, that piece, but once it gets mixed in with a bunch of other things, it's going to contaminate those other things, too.
I was gonna ask you
that. So stuff needs to be clean. So anyway, the economics of recycling have become more difficult. a lot of places where they used to have a drop-off bin that was mm-hmm. open to the public at schools and churches mm-hmm. Because the company that owned those bins would actually pay the schools and churches money, some of the proceeds from recycling the materials, are now charging for those bins to be there mm-hmm. because the materials are not don't have the same value they once had. So that's a problem. Drop-off recycling centers that were operated by area municipalities have found their costs have gone up. And so they've shut down. Lee Summit had closed both of their recycling centers. Blue Springs closed theirs recently. The Job One drop-off residential recycling center in Grandview closed just on the 1st mm-hmm. of this month. North Kansas City closed their drop-off recycling center. And frankly, to some degree, that's because people were not following the guidelines. We're not learning what could be recycled and only bringing what could be recycled. And that causes a lot of problems.
Right. So I wanted to go into contamination. Mm-hmm. Obviously, if I put my empty, I just saw this recently, so I'm going to say it. I have some hummus. I left it in the fridge. It's moldy. And I throw it into the recycle bin because it's plastic.
Right. Please don't do that.
It doesn't, I didn't do that.
It doesn't have to be spotlessly clean, but wipe the sucker out at least. Yeah. Give it a little rinse, mm-hmm. you know. I mean, especially if that goes into curbside recycling. What's going to happen if when that, you know, the trucks they use to pick up curbside recycling, at least here in Kansas City, are compactor trucks.
Yeah.
They're compactor trucks, same kind of compactor trucks that are used for trash for the most part. There are some other types of trucks, but they haven't replaced all the trucks with mm-hmm. Newer trucks. So when that stuff is compacted, what's happened to your moldy old hummus?
Now
I mean,
it's
going all over the paper. It's going all over the other stuff. Paper with hummus on it. You can't recycle that.
Right.
You know, it doesn't have to be absolutely clean, but clean it up for us, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That stuff's unpleasant to work around, too. It smells. Rinse out your milk bottles. A hot day at the recycling center with unwashed milk bottles is not a pleasant place to be, trust me.
What other forms of contamination are there besides food?
Well, the main things, again, are the materials getting in there that aren't supposed to be in there.
That's
like
right.
Plastic bags. Mm-hmm. Plastic bags can be recycled, but unfortunately they can't be recycled with other plastics because of that tangling problem I talked about earlier in the mm-hmm. program, where they get tangled up in the machinery and cause problems with the running of the machinery at the materials recovery facility.
Mm-hmm.
So with plastic bags, you have to take them to a dedicated plastic bag recycler.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of stores now, Walmart and Target and many of the grocery stores in the area, have bins somewhere near the entrance
mm-hmm.
where they'll take clean and dry
right.
plastic bags. They don't want them if they have food all over them either.
Right.
So paper that's in there that's not clean, cleanliness can be a big issue. Again, it doesn't have to be absolutely spotless, but you know, think about, would I want to buy something that was made out of something this dirty? Because ultimately, that stuff has to be in a form that can be turned into high-quality new products, or it's not valuable for recycling.
Mm-hmm.
So you
could reuse that hummus as penicillin.
Oh, wow.
Your own homegrown antibiotics.
Also, I think I see a lot. I try to tell people, you know, I try to tell my neighbors, you know, like, hey, if you want to recycle your pizza box, cool, but only the top part
right.
where there's not grease
yep.
and cheese. So tear that yep. off.
Tear
and,
off the
you know,
food part. Yeah.
Just, and you can, but just make sure you're not putting food and things in mm-hmm. there. And so
absolutely.
If you go to recyclespot.org, they have this nice, like one sheet of paper of, I think you talked about this. And it has pictures and everything mm-hmm. of the do's and then the
yep.
don'ts and the ones that are don't put in your curbside. There's a little asterisk next to it to say that there is an off-site location that you can take those to. And it's just, you know, just that little extra thought that, you know, hopefully will help us ensure that we'll have our recycling centers for a long time.
I mean, the fact of the matter is recycling has to be economically viable because for the most part, it's for-profit companies that actually mm-hmm. do the recycling itself. And cities will support it to some degree, but they can't subsidize it indefinitely. They can't
right.
subsidize it to an unlimited degree.
Mm-hmm.
It has to work economically, or it's just not going to be able to continue. And that's why our recycling options for drop-off centers have been constricted so much over the last couple of years is the economics of it.
All right. Well, I did notice, I saw the articles circulating about China not accepting, you know, as much recycling as it has in the past. Can you share a little bit more about what that looks like for us here in the States, like what that means for us as far as recycling things?
It's not as much of a direct issue for us because being in the heart of the continent, the North American continent, the stuff we recycle here itself probably was not much getting shipped all the way to China. It was more materials produced on the coast.
Mm-hmm.
But because of the change in what those markets are able to do with their materials, that does have ripple effects for us. The fact of the matter is this latest round of restrictions that China's imposing haven't fully gone into effect yet. And it's not really clear to a 100% degree how that's going to affect what is and isn't recyclable. But it's definitely sending ripples through the recycling industry and making us aware that, you know, we really have to get the contamination level down to just a fraction. It's impossible to eliminate contamination entirely.
Right.
But we have to do a better job of it.
All right. Well, Mike, we'll get ready to take our break, but John, Fish, Kerman, thank you so much for joining us.
Happy to have the opportunity.
All right.
Underwriting support for KKFI is provided by the Mid-America Regional Council. Do you need health insurance? Are you worried about losing the coverage you already have? Marketplace plans and insurance providers are changing, but new options are available. Open enrollment is shorter this year. The deadline to apply for 2018 coverage is December 15, 2017. Unsure where to start? Trained counselors can help you compare plans and see if you're eligible for financial assistance. You can contact United Way by telephone at 211 or visit online at coverkc.org.
Alfred McCoy.
Trump has served as a demolition job. He's accelerating the decline of our debt. You got to remember, back in the 50s, we could both have guns and butter. We could have this massive military apparatus around the globe, and we had sufficient funds for domestic prosperity. We had half the world's economy. It's diminished, and now we have to make choices. We can't do it all like we once did.
Alternative Radio, Wednesday morning at 9.
Hello, this is Joseph Jackson. Join me on Cowtown Conversations, where we discuss matters that impact your life as a resident of the Kansas City metropolitan area. Thursday mornings at 9 a.m., right after Democracy Now! On our next episode, we will have professors from the University of Kansas who will be discussing a new grant they just received targeted to help youth from urban core areas. So tune into Cowtown Conversations next Thursday at 9 a.m., right after Democracy Now!
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. As sea levels rise and coastal flooding increases over the next several decades, millions of Americans may need to move inland. Matthew Hauer of the University of Georgia is studying where these climate migrants are likely to go.
We know that people are most likely to move short distances, and we also know that they're most likely to move in concert with their social networks, their kin networks, their friend networks, and so on. And the last thing we know is that people are likely to move for economic reasons.
He says that if the seas rise about 6 feet by the end of the century, 13 million people are likely to move away from the coasts. Of them, 800,000 could move to the Austin, Texas area, and nearly 500,000 could go to Orlando. These figures are based on high scenarios of sea level rise, but Hauer says the possible long-term impacts are important for cities to consider.
These are the kind of considerations that go into water resources and water reservoir building, major roadways and major bridges, and those kind of infrastructure.
So even places that will stay high and dry need to start planning now for how they will accommodate people fleeing rising seas. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Hi, everybody. This is Natural E, back with Eco Radio KC. We just spoke with John Fish Kerman, and I'm putting this link to this picture that we were talking about from recyclespot.org so you can find out what's good to recycle and what's not good to recycle in your curbside. Before we speak with our second guest in studio, I have Mrs. Elnora Jefferson on the phone with the Historic Northeast Midtown Association, and she's going to give us an update on what's coming up in a couple shows. What's going on, Mrs. Jefferson?
Okay. Hi, Aaron. Hi. Yes, thank you very much for having me on. Well, I'll tell you what we're going to be doing is profiling some community people who have an interest, a direct interest in the safety and suitability of the John Garland Park. As you know, about a year ago, we were on your show, and we were talking about working to have a public forum, which has not yet occurred. So I've invited the church, a nearby church, and some concerned citizens, and we would like for your listeners to hear and to understand the gravity of the situation and why a public forum is being requested by the overall community.
Okay, that sounds good. And will we, when we have you in studio, will we be joined by the reverend that is his church is by that John Garland Park? What was his name?
Yes, his name is Pastor Will Adams.
Okay, all right.
Right, yes, that's St. John Missionary Baptist Church.
Okay, well, we look forward to hearing from you and Pastor Williams about the John Garland Park update here in the next few weeks.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, Aaron.
Bye. All right, here we have in studio Eric Person with KC Aquaponics. Good evening, Eric.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. Yeah. Okay, so you do a lot in the community as far as farming and growing. And, I mean, I'm always amazed by the new things that you have going on. I follow you on Facebook. You have a greenhouse. You grow indoors, outdoors. So, but let's start first with, why don't you tell us about KC Aquaponics?
Kansas City Aquaponics is a business that I started after I had a business fail. I had the first indoor aquaponic farm. It was actually licensed as a farm with an agreement with the city that we wouldn't have any cows, chickens, or any kind of other livestock on the property, just the fish. And we were open for about 9 months, and then we closed our doors. And I went from trying to sell produce on growing produce using aquaponics to sell just to going to teach people the basics of aquaponics.
Okay.
From a sort of a do-it-yourself, low-budget sort of approach.
Yes, I remember that first business, and I remember that it was the first of its kind, actually, here in Kansas City. I mean, you had to, it was kind of a struggle to get, because they weren't ready for you, basically. I didn't feel like they were ready for you and what you're trying to do.
We weren't ready for us. So we tried to do too much,
okay.
Admittedly. We didn't have a really good business plan. And then we also had different ideas of what we wanted to do with the business. So trying to do something that's sort of community-based as well as for-profit is really hard. Mm. So,
yeah, I can see how that would be difficult. But in a perfect world, that would be what was up, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
So lessons learned.
Okay, so KC Aquaponics focuses mostly on teaching everyday people how they can grow food for themselves in an aquaponic way?
Correct. So, again, like we just had a workshop this last past Saturday, and we have our workshops. We work with East High School, 1924 Van Brunt, to help their agriculture program get rebooted. So we work with about 80 kids in their ag building, and they sort of let me work out of their greenhouse and help manage and steward the land in return for sort of education and time spent with the students.
Okay.
So it's a really good program just because it allows me to be in a place where I can grow year-round both indoors and outdoors, sort of run my business, if you will. At the same time, I can also give workshops so we have workshops on not only aquaponics, but we also have workshops on seed planting. We have a workshop coming up with Sister Suni Long on kombucha making and apple cider vinegar making, as well as compost tea making. And that's also going to be combined with aquaponics, and that's coming up at the end of January.
Okay.
So we
Where
just
is that?
That's also going to be held at East High School.
Okay.
So that just being sort of in that environment gives us a lot of access to do a lot of things that the school supports us doing.
That's excellent. So. I mean, I know I use apple cider vinegar. Like, no, it's so useful for so many things. So
right.
That would be a great workshop for me. Because it's expensive as well, you know, when you go to the health food store.
Yes, and it's something that we should be making ourselves anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So that's also the idea behind what I do. So I approach what I do from an agrarian sort of agroecology standpoint, you know, returning to our roots, stewarding the land, nurturing the land, returning back to the land, giving back to the land as it gives to us.
Mm-hmm.
And so incorporating all of that, I also I grow holistic and prenatal herbs. The prenatal herbs I'm growing for tinctures and salves that will ideally be sold and used at Uzazi Village, which is a midwife and doula training clinic. And they also give clothing to mothers who are pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
I'm also the community garden coordinator for them, and proud only male staff with a bunch of women, which is great. They're all wonderful sisters and mothers. So next year we just did a project with Giving Grove where we planted two pear trees, two bush cherries, a peach tree, and then in the spring we'll plant two fig trees. And the garden will be 12 raised beds that will transition into the herb garden and then into a serenity garden. So really excited about that project. Also working with the Charlotte Street, hopefully the project to get some murals painted on the back of Uzazi Village. So lots of moving parts on that, but that's kind of what I like to do. So I also do a lot of, like I said, agroecology, but so that's kind of permaculture design, again, traditional land stewardship, aquaponics, and then animal pathology is what we're studying with the kids right now. So sheep, chickens, bees, and hopefully next year rabbits.
It's just, I don't even know what to say. It's just incredible to me. You know, I do admire you for all that you're involved in and know how to do, and your willingness to share that, you know, and teach that.
Thanks.
So that's really cool. And I had no idea you're doing all these things. I knew you were at East High School. But I didn't know how deep that went. And then it was Uzazi Village, you know, so that's awesome. Keep doing what you're doing.
Thanks.
What did you say?
Animal pathology. So the students are basically learning about animals that are that would be relatable to Missouri sort of agriculture or farming. Urban farming is what we focus on, but and we also have a rural setting close enough to Missouri where we can do things like alpacas, sheep, goats, and have a lot of chickens. And also things like rabbits.
Mm-hmm.
And not only just as pets and a source of protein, but also as a source of biofuel. So using the waste as a catalyst to spread more nutrients to your soil or as something to use to start compost tea, just things like that. So the whole way around. Basically not wasting anything.
Right. Okay, so I wish I had something like this in high school. So tell me about your experience working with these high school students. Had any of the students had any type of experience like this before? And how has it changed their lives from what you can see?
Great question. So I have actually been in the school for about a year. Last December, we took hold of the greenhouse and started doing different things in there. And the kids were really engaged just by seeing the fish and the stuff. But we didn't really have a huge system established. We were just breeding fish at the time. And then once, so then summer happened, and then spring, once fall came, a lot of the students were sort of, okay, there was an ag program at the end of the school year last year, but most of those kids came back who were sophomores and juniors, who are now obviously juniors and seniors, and so they are learning about the food they eat as far as flavors. Like before, it was just like, ooh, gross, you're eating that, and that's dirty, you haven't even washed it, to, oh, wow, that tastes like pizza, oh, to, you know, oh, look what I grew, don't eat my vegetables, those are mine. So watching them go from that model and seeing how they were unsuccessful, quote unquote, and successful in their own raised beds, on their own right, they learned plant pathology. So they understood why some of their plants didn't grow because they planted them too deep, or they planted them not deep enough, or they learned the difference between, a plant that's can be planted in the fall that will remain hardy as opposed to a plant planted in the fall that won't last but will bolt or burn in the summertime. So they're really grasping. They have to because it's their grade. But there are some problems like language barriers. The thing about East High School is they funnel most of the children with language barriers to that school. So at any given time, we could have up to 20 to 25 different dialects being spoken, if you will. And so it's really multicultural, diverse, which is great. Biodiversity is great, but sometimes the language barrier keeps students from understanding some things. And it creates some sort of frustration, but the teachers, Mr. Andrew Killen and Mr. Zach McCullough, are very, very patient. And so they understand the culture. When I met Zach McCullough, the teacher, about 2 years ago, he one of the first conversations that we had were about the students that he cares about and how he really wanted to start the ag program because the school's in a food desert. And so he knew that there were kids that would benefit just from learning how to grow food. In that neighborhood, one thing that is also sort of ironic and also frustrating is that some of the kids who attend East High School's parents are in the Roots for Refugees program.
Right.
So there's a disconnect between that, making a connection to get kids to sort of learn how to grow food and then sell it. But there is a business model at East High School to where the kids can learn once they start at ninth grade, where they can start to pick a career path. And so hopefully we can merge and intersect the ag program with helping them understand what they can do to make money to grow, or just growing food to supplement what they normally have to buy. Because I can tell you, as a farmer, you don't make very much money growing food unless you can grow a lot of it. So.
I have so many questions, but there's only a few minutes left. just a few. I guess for the folks who are listening, who are like, I could take an aquaponics course. What does that look like? What can they expect?
It's a great question. The aquaponics class, it's about an hour class, and then we do a tour. It goes over the basics. It goes over what you need to start a system. It would go over what you would need to get a system started and keep it going. I focus more on the plants and the water biology, chemistry, and the engineering of the system more than I do the fish as a source of protein. I don't eat tilapia, which a lot of people find ironic, because I just don't eat that as a source of protein. But I also raise the fish to teach sort of pet pathology and taking care of the fish themselves, because I'm breeding them. So mm-hmm. that's my goal, is breeding tilapia for the waste and the affluence that they provide me to grow my vegetables. So that's where I approach aquaponics from. So if you came to a class, you would learn how to start a system, maintain a system, mm-hmm. focused on the plants and getting the water right for the first year, and then increasing the system mm-hmm. size.
And this is something that perhaps someone would put into... It's not an outdoor thing, right?
Or it can be either or.
Okay.
It can be either or, indoor, okay. outdoor. It can be a pond. Uh-huh. It can be a swimming pool.
Wow.
It can be...
What if someone had a swimming pool in their backyard? They're like, you know what? This is going to be an aquaponics machine. What would that?
They should call me so that I can bid the job for them and do the plumbing.
Wow.
Because that's what I also
do. I mean, how much food would that put up? They really had that swimming pool full of fish doing their thing.
It depends on how much food. I mean, swimming pools are really good spots to grow things like crawfish, freshwater prawns, or mm-hmm. catfish, which mm-hmm. I personally like. That would give them a lot of room to swim. You could also have your filter, the sand filter, act as part of the filter, but I would also increase the biofilter because of the load. But mm-hmm. it's doable. Have a deck to the side where all your food's growing.
Mm-hmm. I don't understand. Like, my mind cannot keep up with you. I can't
so
keep up with you, Eric.
Ideal.
We do only have 30 seconds. So
okay.
What we want to leave him with. This is Eric Person. He's with
Kansas City Aquaponics, mm-hmm. Black Urban Grower, KC on Instagram. Do a
all
lot
right.
of fun stuff.
All
Follow
right.
me. Thanks.
Hit him up. This is Natural E. I'm going to take us out with a few events we have coming up. Urban Wood Workshop is December 12th from 8:30 a.m. to 10:30 a.m. at the Anita B. Gorman Conservation Discovery Center at 4750 Troost. Architects, designers, contractors, and furniture makers can learn how to use reclaimed urban lumber in their projects at this Urban Wood Reclaim Kansas City's Fallen Trees Workshop. Millions of ash trees are expected to die from the emerald ash borer in the coming years. There is an opportunity to use these ash, as well as other species of trees downed from storms, age, and disease that they call urban lumber. So you can find out how to do that at the Urban Wood Workshop, December 12th, 8:30 to 10:30 a.m. And then on December 15th from 8:30 to 10:30 a.m., you can join the celebration of 6 local sustainable success stories at the annual award ceremony Friday, December 15th. That's taking place at 4801 Rock Hill Road. They'll be recognizing Antioch Urban Growers, Common Ground, Connecting for Good, Grown in Ivanhoe, and the Johnson County Community College. And finally, Wednesday, December 13th from 4 to 6 p.m. at the Mid-America Regional Council, which is at 600 Broadway, you can go attend the Kansas City Environmental Management Commission. They promote environmental awareness and resource efficiency to the city's leaders and staff to assist the progress of Kansas City towards sustainability. The general public is encouraged to attend and observe meetings and to join and participate in its efforts. Let's see what else we got. I think those are all the events I have today, Mike.
All right, we're going to go out with This Week in Water.
Arctic melting may be triggering California's drought and fires. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
As of Sunday morning, the largest fire in Southern California was again raging out of control and threatening the towns of Carpinteria and Montecito. The LA Times reported that nevertheless, firefighters had made some progress in other areas.
The Thomas Fire in Ventura County is the biggest so far, destroying about 700 structures. Other smaller fires occurred in Los Angeles County, Riverside, and south to San Diego. At one point, the Thomas Fire was growing by the size of a football field every second.
Meteorologist Eric Holthouse, writing in Rolling Stone, noted that it now should be the peak of California's rainy season, but instead, bone-dry winds fed the wildfires.
Rainfall in the Los Angeles area has been scant. From October 1st until now, LA normally receives 2 inches, but has received only about a tenth of an inch.
There is no fire season anymore, a Cal Fire spokesman told Reuters, particularly in Southern California, meaning fires are occurring year-round. And Governor Jerry Brown said that the situation was now the new normal.
Holthouse says there's no denying the facts anymore. What's happening in California is a climate emergency. And what scientists have been warning about for decades is here.
A new study out last week by researchers at the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory concludes that the massive ice thaw in the Arctic is triggering changes in the atmosphere that are likely to shrink rainfall in California.
And new data is showing that the Arctic is warming faster than the rest of the planet. Each month, NOAA produces a climate report, and one of the stations where it receives data is located in Utqiagvik, Alaska, formerly Barrow, the northernmost place in the U.S.
But the data this December from that station was missing, as were all of the numbers for 2017 and for the last few months of 2016.
Deke Arndt writes on the NOAA website that the average temperature at the weather station has changed so rapidly that it effectively stopped the location from being used for analysis, leaving northern Alaska appearing a little cooler than it really was.
He told Earther that it is the first time climate change is responsible for an American weather station being messed up.
The actual data on the warming Arctic is dramatic. Arndt compared two time periods over the last 40 years. On average, Utqiagvik warmed 6.5 degrees Fahrenheit. Even more striking is that in October of this year, the temperature was nearly 8 degrees higher than average.
Donald Trump radically reduced by about 85% the size of the Bears Ears Monument established by Barack Obama. Trump also reduced Grand Staircase Escalante by almost 40% from what President Bill Clinton designated.
Five Native American tribes have already filed suit to stop Trump's action, and Patagonia, the outdoor clothing company, sued, calling the move illegal. The tribe's point is that the Antiquities Act does not allow a president to revoke or modify a monument, only to designate one.
At least two other suits to stop the move were also filed by 10 environmental and wilderness groups.
Unless Trump's action is stopped, the Salt Lake City Tribune reports that unprotected lands could be eligible for drilling.
Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke and top Utah Republicans said mining and drilling issues played no role in the decision. But the Washington Post uncovered documents showing that a uranium company lobbied to scale back Bears Ears so it could get easier access to uranium deposits.
Uranium mining is particularly sensitive to the Navajo, which is one of five tribes suing. The Navajo's nearby reservation has about 500 old mines which have not been cleaned up and still contaminate water wells, springs, and storage tanks.
The official death toll in Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria has come under scrutiny. The New York Times analyzed data and found that in the 42 days after the Category 4 storm, more than 1,000 people than usual died across the island.
But the official toll is only 64. One of the difficulties in determining the fatalities may be the lack of electricity, because only 65% of the island has power restored.
The situation in Puerto Rico is still grave. CNN reported last week that the Army Corps of Engineers has installed about 18,000 temporary roofs on people's homes, but this is only a bit over a quarter of those requested.
The mayor of San Juan, Carmen Yulín Cruz, is also pointing out another devastating problem facing Puerto Rico, the Republican tax bill.
The House version would effectively impose a 20% tax on goods manufactured in Puerto Rico, which could kill any chance of rebuilding the island. Other officials say that the result would be companies such as pharmaceuticals moving to other countries.
And finally, if we were able to strip away all the daily sounds we're accustomed to, traffic, music, or even birds chirping, we'd be made aware of something scientists have known for decades. The Earth hums.
Scientists have been attempting to record the hum since the late 1950s, and there have been hundreds of attempts to measure it using seismometers on land, but no one has been certain where it comes from.
Now, new research is attempting to explain it, and scientists think it might have something to do with the ocean. And because water covers 70% of the Earth, if seismologists want to get to the source of this phenomenon, it'd be good to detect it under the sea.
European scientists did just that. They placed seismometers near Madagascar to make the first observations of the Earth's buzz from the bottom of the ocean, which is tricky because the underwater world is noisy with waves and earthquakes and migrations of sea life.
But the team was able to use signals from seismometers they'd placed on the ocean floor and cross-reference with data from terrestrial stations, and voila, all that remained was the hum.
And even though the buzz is imperceptible to our ears, recording it is an important step toward figuring out what actually produces it.
Hypotheses range from atmospheric disturbances or ocean waves pounding on the seafloor to possibly currents whisking over continental shelves.
Whatever the cause, this new research may get scientists closer to identifying the source, which could give us more knowledge about the inner workings of our planet and help us to be more in sync with the tune it hums.
Until next time, that's This Week in Water. This Week in Water is supported by the American Water Works Association, bringing together the best and brightest minds in the water sector at ACE 18. Learn more at awwa.org/ACE18.
The Jackson County Bar Association presents Law 101, free legal classes taught by judges and licensed attorneys. Classes are from 6 p.m. to 7:30 p.m. at the Greg Kleiss Community Center, 1600 John Buck O'Neill Way, Kansas City, Missouri. The next class is Wednesday, December 13th on juvenile law. This message, a public service of 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Thanks for listening to Eco Radio KC on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.